begin? When we'll pass time. Many of you already know our keynote speaker, but for those of you who don't, I'll spend the next hour rehearsing and rehashing her career and leave her about 5 minutes for a keynote address. She's an extraordinarily good exemplar of an urban scholar, someone who has been committed to and very passionate about what happens in cities and urban scholarship. Like me, I think she was originally trained to be a political sociologist, and then we saw the light and shifted to urban. Her first book, whose title escapes me, has really set the stage for a great deal of research over the past 30 years, especially on topics of the transformation of the older industrial city, the creation of arts, and then the subsequent gentrification of the city. This is a book on Soho and how it was remade after being an industrial district. And it was a path-breaking book and really has set the stage for a great deal of work. She was the first person to show the importance of artists in the revitalization of an area of the city. And now, if you read the New York Times a couple of days ago, there are efforts underway in the United States with big money behind it to create art districts in something like 35 or 40 cities across America on the assumption that the arts can revitalize the city. And Sharon really showed the way to do that. She also showed what happened when artists move into a district and the district becomes hot property, and then the people with big money move in and the artists are forced out and gentrification happens. So this is a landmark work. One of the books, her next book was a book with the compelling title Landscapes of Power, and I think it was mentioned 10 or 15 times yesterday, but it's a wonderful image of the relationship between power in urban areas and landscapes. And it's that term, it's, you know, just been a concept that's captured a lot of work, especially for people, you know, who want to capture both the visual and the economic features of change that's going on in cities. What I particularly found compelling in that book was her argument about the tension between place and markets. And it may have been, for me, the first time that I saw someone really take the notion of place and use it in a very powerful and important way. Shortly thereafter, she published this very important work, taking Lewis Mumford to task that it's not just the culture of cities, but it's the cultures of cities that one has to examine. And in this book, she talked about the symbolic economy and symbols and how the city is being remade in terms of different cultures within the city. And she's continued that work, and her most recent work is called Naked City, and I think it's her final, at least you said to me, it's her, yes, her final work on New York. But I guarantee you it won't be her final work on New York. You know, after a while you say, well, I was tired of New York, but, you know, I'm still living here. I got to do something here. So what Sharon will probably do is we'll observe it. And in her elegant and eloquent way, she will write compelling and descriptive prose about Sharon. It's my great honor to present my great friend, Sharon Zook.
Wow. I asked Tony a few weeks ago if he would speak about himself at this conference. He's too modest to do that, but it's a sign of his great generosity that he speaks about me at his conference. So I'm truly moved by that. You know, last night when I offered a toast to Tony and Susan, I said I was honored and delighted to be asked to make that toast. I'm also honored and delighted to be the keynote speaker at the at this conference. But I was anxious about the toast because I think, frankly, that the toasts are the most important part of this conference. I'm even more anxious about this presentation. First, because it's been a long time since I have made a PowerPoint presentation with no photographs of places, just words. So I'm a little bit anxious about all the words and the lack of graphic visual images, or photographs actually, of places. And I'm also anxious because the origins of this talk lie in some very worrisome thoughts that I have had about urban sociology for the past 10 or 15 years, ever since I was the chair of the urban sociology section at ASA. I've been worried that urban sociology is in a crisis. And it seems weird to say that when we have just had a rich day of presentations, of research, with really interesting ideas, and we ourselves are genuinely interested in everybody else's work, and we're seeing, you know, we're very excited by seeing all the interconnections between things that people are discovering. So I'm a little anxious to start out in this perfect orgy of urban sociology by saying that I feel there's a crisis in urban sociology. One of the problems that I saw when I was the chair is that very few professors of urban sociology, very few professors of sociology who list their specialties in the graduate guide, the guide to graduate departments in the United States, list urban sociology as one of their specialties. I was really surprised because we have a healthy section membership, and even a modestly growing section membership. We've had a tremendous success with City and Community. We have no lack of manuscript submissions and great people who are associated with the journal. We read all the time that the world is becoming an ever more urbanized place, and people from conservative economists to the staff of Scientific American are publishing that cities have come back and they're really important and cities are getting bigger and we've really got to pay attention to cities. But, you know, here in the heartland of U.S. sociology, it seems to me that urban sociology has been marginalized because it seems to be taught at fewer places than before. There are, therefore, fewer graduate students coming out who are prepared to do urban research and to carry on the tradition of concern with urban topics. To some degree, we've been marginalized from the and pushed out of the core of urban U.S. sociology, so that we're no longer in the 1920s when the Chicago School social scientists were able to say that the study of the city is sociology and sociology is the study of the city. This is also a different period from the time when some of us were growing up. Harvey Mollich and I were talking about this briefly yesterday, in the 1960s. When the disturbances, riots, the culmination of decades of racial discrimination in cities sparked insurrections, both in the United States and in France, where urban sociology was just beginning in the 1960s, but there was a period of intellectual as well as political ferment. And because of the conflict, the violence, the U.S. government was putting money into urban research, and there was a real feeling of being in the forefront of an intellectually as well as politically exciting kind of research. But we've also been marginalized by the rise of so many new subfields of urban sociology, particularly in the study of race and ethnicity, and the study of immigration. so that urban sociology has been pushed out of the mainstream of attention in U.S. sociology. And it's one of, certainly in my undergraduate institution where I teach, it's one of, you know, many different electives. And this is part of the feeling that impelled us to initiate an urban sociology journal within ASA. We discussed 12 years ago, we discussed the very small representation of urban sociology in ASR and AJS. So really, I've been worrying about the crisis of urban sociology for a number of years. But those fears and anxieties subsided while I was writing my books and reading your books, and while we were founding City and Community. But in the past 10 years or so, there have been a number of articles in various urban journals about urban sociology, and kind of questioning what urban sociology really is today, even in the face of the huge urbanization of the rest of the world. And this reminded me of an article that I had read many years ago, Manuel Castells' article, Is There an Urban Sociology? This was published in a French journal in 1968. It was actually a labor journal. There was no French Urban Sociology Journal. In fact, there is no French Urban Sociology Journal, if I remember correctly, even today. But it was published in a Sociology of Labor Journal in 1968, an auspicious year of social ferment. And even though the Althusserian framework that Castells had adopted until then, he relinquished afterwards, A lot of the criticisms that Castells made of urban sociology remain fresh. He said, if urban sociologists study the city, what are they really studying? Either they're studying the political economic system that structures cities, that is, they're studying capitalism, or they're studying various cultural forms that are synonymous with modernity. So there is no such thing as a city. I mean, there are real cities, certainly, but there is no theoretically distinct subject called the city. And then in this article, he reviews some French empirical studies that were being done in the early to mid-60s. Interestingly enough, Henri Lefebvre appears in this article as the author of a study of neighborhoods rather than as the social theorist we now know him to be. And Castells says, well, really all of these studies, U.S. studies as well as French studies, come down to how people's behavior is shaped by their social groupings, so that we think we're looking at communities, but in fact we're looking at families, or we're looking at social networks, or we're looking at social class or social status. We're not looking at something that can be isolated and called the city. Now, bear in mind that, of course, urban sociology, what we call urban sociology, is in fact, as Tony has implicitly suggested, it's the sociology of space. But people don't call it the sociology of space. In fact, I don't know anybody who calls it the sociology of space. We persist in calling what we study urban sociology. We might study rural areas, we might study exurbs, we might study, you know, counties, some geographical or territorial unit. But the urban is not only the city. That was not exactly the point that Castells was making. But certainly the way we talk about spaces today reinforced a feeling that I've had for many years, not being a student of the Chicago School, rather a student of the David Harvey Urban Political Economy School, I have always thought that we should call ourselves sociologists of space, not urban sociologists. But you know, this uneasy symmetry between the city and the urban stoked my continual anxiety about what urban sociology is. Castells also raises another point about scientific method. Again, at that time, his idea of scientific method was not the Cartesian or laboratory kind of scientific method that we learn in U.S. sociology. It was a very particular structuralist Marxist kind of scientific method. But the smaller questions that he raises under that rubric are really important. They're still important. Are we objective or subjective? If our research is funded by the state, maybe a more important question in France, where almost all research is financed by the state, are we agents of the state? Or are we trying to make a social change? What's the relationship between ideology and science? I mean, that's kind of an Althusserian question, but I mean it in a very common sense way. What's the relation between our own politics and the research that we want to do? Actually, I see Jan sitting in the front row with his eyes open, so I know he's awake and listening to me at this hour of Saturday morning. But, I'm thinking about what Jan said yesterday about his research on Native Americans. And, there's definitely an ideology of politics in there. He's not, in a detached way, looking at this particular group of people who happen to live in a particular place. He's looking at the historical context of misery. And this is, what I think a lot of us urban sociologists are trying to look at, the spatial context of spatial and social context of misery, which makes us maybe less scientific. I don't know. So what do we do when we do urban sociology if we have all these anxieties? Since I promised Tony I would not speak about him and I would not speak about myself, I'm not going to speak about myself, but I am going to speak about him. So I'm going to say that the first of four approaches we can take to doing urban sociology is to do what Tony does. What does he do? Well, first of all, in all of his work, and I will not exhume, excavate, and so on, all of his work going back to why he is persona non grata in Milwaukee, I will not bring that up. Tony always attacks the substantive issues, right? He's not looking for correlations between variable A and variable B. He's not running a zillion statistical tables. My hat is off to those of you who do that, but this is not what Tony does. And in fact, in the book on public space that he published with Zach, he categorizes uses of public space in a way that applies to his own work, because he himself studies power, expression, human expression, and social order. And this, in fact, is a nice trilogy, a nice triptych. Anyway, it's a nice set of three terms that can apply to what a lot of us study, maybe what all of us study, when we do urban sociology. Second, Tony does qualitative analysis, for the most part, anyway, does qualitative analysis. And this affects the not only the kinds of questions that we ask and the kinds of generalizations that we can make, but it affects the tone of our writing. The way, if we use a qualitative method or qualitative methods, usually tell a very small story about a very small number of cases. But we do usually do case studies. And with Joe Fagan, Tony has written a book defending the case study method, so that we are literally writing stories when we do urban sociology. I know everybody's supposed to write a story because that's what interests people, and intellectually, that's as well as emotionally. A story is compelling. We teach all our graduate students to start their dissertation chapters with a vignette. I guess we've learned that from the ethnographers. We wind up maybe doing, if we do what Tony does, we do urban sociology as writing the biography of a city. I have to think a little bit more about what that means. Maybe we can discuss that in the question and comment section after our talk. But I'm thinking about the new book that's called The Biography of Cancer, the book about cancer called The Biography of a Disease. And maybe this is the natural progression from people writing memoirs to people writing biographies of other things. But there are, you know, books being written now, not by sociologists, that call themselves biographies, not histories, but biographies, life stories of things that are not not human. Or we can do what the papers at this conference are doing, and we can write stories about everyday life by studying ordinary people. This is, of course, related to what Tony does, since Tony has selected the people who are involved in this conference. But it's not exactly the same as what Tony has done. But when we write about ordinary people, we usually are focusing on the way they create spaces, whether those spaces are neighborhoods or the communities where they choose to live, or they are Native American spaces, or they are... I had a whole list of the conference papers, but I don't want to go through every single paper, even when they're restrooms, right? These are people creating spaces. The Freedom Tower, a building. And this is, again, what a lot of us write about, even if we think we're writing about some other sort of human behavior. In an overall way, what we're writing about is people creating spaces or reacting to spaces in which they are constrained to move. Or we're writing about people trying to create spaces of action, spaces of residence, spaces of work, despite huge constraints, political constraints, constraints of economic resources. In other words, usually we are taking a conflict approach to doing sociology, whether or not we would identify ourselves, going around the table now, as partisans of the conflict theory of sociology. But basically we're writing about conflict, inequity, and people struggling against the odds. Or if we're writing about real estate developers, we're writing about people who have a lot of resources and they are flipping the dice in a way that will constrain other people and constrain the future steps of building the urban environment. But implicit in what we all do, I think, is the idea that our research will maybe help people to change their lives. Now, we're not going to discover the cure to cancer, a cure for cancer, but we're maybe going to show that something is so wrong with the way the built environment and is allocated to different groups of people, that someone will listen to us and take action, or maybe we'll help them. In Peter's case, we'll help them to take action to change their lives. And this relates to what I said in the toast last night. When I met Tony at the Social Science History Association panel a number of years ago, the panelists agreed that urban sociologists want to make the world a better place. And maybe this is true of all sociologists. Maybe it's an occupational hazard or something. But I think that in all of our work, we're struggling along with the people whom we're studying. We're struggling not just to make sense of their struggles, but we're struggling to at least imply a better way, a fairer way. And this reminds me, of course, of the Democratic Party. We're a big tent like U.S. sociology that allows many different approaches and many different problems. Well, how do we do urban sociology how do we do urban sociology then if we are such a big tent and anything goes, and any approach is okay, and any topic is fine, as long as it has some connection with space or place or urban or rural or some geography or, you know, something. How do we draw the lines, or do we want to draw the lines about around ourselves? Are we a big tent or a small science? The third approach to urban sociology I have sort of exhumed from the other urban studies journals, like Urban Studies and the International Journal of Urban and Regional Research, that are not published in the United States. And there we have a much more complex intellectual scene than we generally have in U.S. sociology, in any of the U.S. sociology journals, where researchers internationally are struggling with the major social and political and cognitive and ideological issues of our time, the 21st century. What kinds of spaces do we live in now that everybody is connected electronically? When everything is available to us all the time, across hours, days, years, and centuries, what does time mean? Do we have a single urbanism, or are there multiple urbanisms? What is modernity? Is there a non-Western modernity that is just as modern as Western modernity? And then how does the built environment fit into any of these questions when people are moving all the time? You know, the flows idea, right? When people are moving all the time, how do we study them? Do we think of them as transnational, multicultural? You know, what words do we use for either the spaces which are unstable or the people which are also moving all the time and mobile? You know, what language do we use? And then there are some other major problems, smaller problems than those, but they're major problems nonetheless. Is there only one urban sociology that is equally applicable to the global north and global south, to the east and to the west? Or maybe those kinds of bipolarities are not even relevant to talk about. But when you do interact with colleagues from other countries, read their work, you do see a tremendous explicit challenge to the paradigms that have been developed in the hegemonic heart of social science in North America and Western Europe, and the questions, problems, groping towards paradigms in both East Asia and the Global South. And then there's the question, the famous geographer's question of scale. What are we talking about? A city? Are we talking about a nation? Are we talking about a region? Are we talking about what? And in one of Neil Brenner's recent articles, he talks about a generalized planetary condition, which is urban. And when I got to that point, I thought, oh my God, you know, it used to be with the Chicago School that the city was to study the city was to study the world, but now we have to study the world to study the city. What, you know, what are we studying? So this only stoked my anxiety further. And indeed, not to go through every point on these charts, but we do operate in a very different intellectual universe from the early urban sociologists. All of the assumptions that they made, the science models that were important to them, have been superseded by other kinds of science. The understanding of the individual has been completely changed. The idea of how people act with other people is different. Yes, we still do social interaction, but we also do co-presence, and we do virtual co-presence as well as physical co-presence. There's a lot more indeterminacy in science today, and so there has to be a lot more indeterminacy in social science. But, you know, that's hard. it's hard for us to, maybe it's hard for me anyway, to adjust to how do we write this way and not sound uncertain or foolish. So I just want to make a very small suggestion that we accentuate what we do by choosing a fourth approach and to say the city is not necessarily a geographical unit, but the city is the social imaginary that humans have constructed over centuries. This is how we imagine humans live. This is the governance form, whatever specifics of the governance form are. This is the habitat governance form, the city, and we should concentrate on trying to tell stories about the city. As they say, where I come from, there are 8 million stories in the Naked City, but we know that there are more than 8 million stories. There are a lot of stories and a lot of cities. So I think that we have to take as our mission to tell the story, as we already do, but to make this our explicit mission, telling the story of how people struggle to make spaces. I think this is what U.S. sociologists are moving toward, and Tony is certainly moving toward, when they advocate this place and space rubric. Now, I'm not so comfortable with placing myself in the place and space rubric, because to me the word space should include the attempts to make cultural meaning out of spaces. But I always remember what a sociologist at another major institution told me once when I visited to give a talk, and he said, "Gee, you're interested in space, you should go talk to the geographers here." So, you know, there still is not a real place in sociology for those of us who write about space and say that we're writing about space. There are a few people who have written about films and novels recently who say that the city is a character in the film, or the city is a character in the novel. And I kind of like that. I mean, usually it's easier to find that a building is a character, or a street is a character, or a neighborhood is a character. But I'm wondering, what is the city's story? Of course, the city doesn't have only one story, but I'm wondering what kind of story we can tell, and how do we know what the city's story is? Let's say there's a method called reading a city. Well, what do we do when we read a city? We read a city when we visit a strange city and we look at the maps, the authoritative visual guides. We read the reviews on Yelp and in TripAdvisor. We walk on the streets and our eye picks out the universal language of the so-called interesting neighborhoods. Usually those are the arts districts or the places where we feel we can get a really good meal. So reading a city often comes down to an individual author making a compilation of signs that are important to her or him. How do you tell a story then if you're not placing yourself as the main character of the story? And I confess that a reviewer said about my last book, Naked City, that the book has a whining tone. Now, that's something only my husband can say about me. But I think that that was actually a reviewer in a British newspaper. And I think that he was saying that the book was too much about me and how I read changes in New York City during the past 30 years. So how do we tell a story of a city? Do we tell it about ourselves? The famous, the postmodern ethnographer's dilemma? Do we tell the story of the city by telling a story of ourselves? Or do we tell the story of, as our conference heading says, ordinary lives? I suspect that telling a story, though, is emotionally very compelling to readers. This is why students have come back to urban ethnography, why urban ethnography is, I think, enjoying a resurgence now, because maybe students are tired of all the quantitative studies, and they feel they're not really, you know, getting to the nitty-gritty of the real stories of the city. By the same token, again, as with reading a city, ethnography is often a young author's game. Those of us, you know, when we get older, we have other obligations. We can't spend 24/7 out in the field hanging out with whatever, you know, hanging out with lowlifes or artists or bohemians or country music musicians. Of course, Richard is never going to get so old that he can't do that. But some of us get past that point. So I'm back to a work method. You know, how do we tell a city story? And now I confess I am going to show three visual images from my own research. I think that we can tell stories of buildings. Who built a building? Why did they build it in that location? How did that building fit into the larger context of the city at that time? If the building no longer exists, why did it become derelict? Why was it destroyed? What has been built in its place? What does this building tell us in its story about the story of the city? See me privately for the story of this building. We could tell stories of streets. And with Zhang Ming and my colleague Phil Kazanitz, I'm working on an international research project on shopping streets, local shopping streets in six global cities around the world. This is one of them that I've worked on. What stories can we tell about this street? Again, as with buildings, how does the street fit into the history of the city? How do the store owners, the building owners, the shoppers, the surrounding residents, the supply chains, the media, how do all these things fit together not only to form the story of this space, but to form the story of how the space fits into the city? And then we should tell stories of neighborhoods, as we do and as some of you have been doing at this conference. We should tell the stories of ordinary people standing around and eating herring on the street and try to show how those herring eaters fit into the larger story of the city. So I come down kind of against the global urbanists, my colleagues and friends. I come down to a very modest position by advocating that we tell the stories of bounded spaces and see how those stories fit into a larger picture. So I'm happy to have reactions. Thanks. We have time for... you don't have to write them down. You can shout them out. This is like an undergraduate class, like the initial... But fortunately, unlike the undergraduates, you're sitting all over instead of in the back of the room. So that's very, very good. Mary, you had your hand up first.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I guess, be more optimistic and ask a little bit more why. I still don't hear why you're so anxious or pessimistic. And, you know, here we are, urban sociologists in wonderful universities, so it's not like folks get jobs, our students get jobs. And I don't feel marginalized as an urban sociologist, so I want to speak for the, I think that we're quite popular, even with the subfields, you know. Yes, some of us study race in the city, some of us study immigration in the city, but I don't think that dilutes urban sociology by any stretch, so I just want to hear a little bit more about why you think there's a crisis.
Well, again, I can only go back to the way I felt when I started leafing through the graduate guide to the guide to graduate departments in the U.S., and I saw so few people teaching urban sociology compared to, you know, all the other possibilities that exist. And then I did a really quick geographical analysis of where these people are concentrated. I know Hillary and I have talked about this before, and we urban sociologists are mainly in New York and Chicago. Yeah, we're mainly in New York and Chicago. So I'm happy if everybody else here is optimistic and I'm the outlier. That's okay. I'm happy to be proven the pessimist in this regard. Is that okay? Tony?
Yeah, I just want to ask that I have a commitment to a certain way.
You can't hear you, Tony.
I have a commitment to a certain way of looking at the world. You and I share it, but, you know, I think, like Mary, I'm less pessimistic than you. And, you know, there are various ways of measuring that, you know, optimism. But one of the things that gives me a sense of optimism and hope is this article that Tom Buren wrote was published in Annual Review of Sociology. Is there space or place in sociology? Do you know that that article came out only a few years ago when I was just checking this? It's cited over 500 or 600 times. I mean, and what that means to me is that people are finally acknowledging the importance of place. And, you know, I mean, something that Harvey, you know, recognized years ago. So place is what urban sociology is all about, what we do who do urban. And I think there are ways that may not show up in the curriculum of sociology departments, but showing up in a way that social scientists and others think about the world, that place has a very important part in the world.
Good. Again, I'll be happy if I'm the only person who's pessimistic about this. I know Tom Buren's article. I don't know Tom. I think I've met him once.
Right.
But he's never gone farther with that, as far as I know. Right? You know, like, it's out there, and it's probably been cited by every member of this section, of the urban sociology section. But it's not a piece that hasn't, as far as I can see, inspired other people's research. And it hasn't inspired Tom's research. And, when you know, I was very, I actually don't like that piece. Because the piece wasn't urban. It was about spaces, right? It's kind of a Latourian, more Latourian than Lefebvrean approach. And it's, you know, like buildings, rooms, and he studied with Merton. It was kind of like Robert Merton now is looking at space.
Yes.
So for me it was not an important article because it was about structured spaces, but they could be any kinds of spaces. They weren't urban spaces. They were all kinds of spaces, as I recall, like laboratories. And they talk about a lab in a building, something like that. So I never liked that piece. My apologies to those of you who like that.
Sorry.
Hillary.
You know, I really enjoyed what
enjoyed
this
talk,
like very provocative and I wanted to suggest that maybe, first of all, that we can tell good narratives about good numbers, too, and we can tell the story. And that we shouldn't feel that some of the lessons that we've drawn that don't apply to those who are functioning. But the main theme for us that we've been discussing on the crisis, I think, is reflected in the fact that American politics has moved on as well. And Margaret Weir, a long time ago, pointed out how important it is that the center of gravity of population in the United States has moved to suburbs. And given the construction of political jurisdictions, that cities don't have the kind of political clout that they had in the 1960s. So it's not just that the Democratic Party, you know, is now, looks very different than it did. But it's also that the political weight of cities in policy, and therefore the resources that get allocated to cities come through very different mechanisms than they did 50 years ago. So now there's a lot of action going on in the states. And we have been, I mean, there are certain subjects that we as urban sociologists we need to slightly reorient our thinking about power.
So while your work has been really terrific in pointing that these are landscapes of power, but let's follow them out. Some of the folks at Brookings, they want to talk about metro politics. I mean, it's a game that's played as much in state legislatures nowadays than it is in city halls. And while we may therefore shrink our perspective down to the level of neighborhoods, I want to suggest that this scaling up, that there's one level of scale that we haven't paid much attention to politically, and that's the level of district power, you know, of states or the medium range.
Yeah, that's really important, and I'm sorry that I didn't address that at all. So thank you very much for that, Hillary. You raised several different issues nested together there. One is, again, as Harvey and I were chatting about this yesterday, not just the long-term suburbanization and deurbanization, I guess we could say, of infrastructure, of capital investment, of people in the U.S., the deurbanization of that starting in the early 1900s and accelerating after 1950, but also the lack of crisis, as I mentioned, the lack of, you know, the cities are, as Harvey said much better than I yesterday in our chat, if the cities aren't burning, then the politicians are not paying attention. But also, you're mentioning the metro level kind of discourse is really interesting. I was stunned a few months ago when I went out to give a talk at the University of Texas in Arlington, which is in the middle of the wilderness, the middle of sprawl between Dallas and Fort Worth. And I was stunned and amused to hear people refer to that area, that increasingly densely settled area, but nonetheless everybody spread out, as a metroplex. And when we were in Las Vegas, I went to a really interesting session that was very ill attended, surprisingly enough, where the researcher, the demographers from Brookings West, which is based at UNLV, were speaking about the metropolitan growth of Las Vegas. Actually, that session confirmed all of those negative comments about Las Vegas that I later got in trouble for. But it was really interesting to hear the Brookings people talk about the metropolitan growth, of Las Vegas as a metropolis, and they were, of course, referring to this regionalization of economic power and political influence. And that reminded me.
Longford was also banned the Regional Plan Association.
Absolutely. But in New York, it's been really hard. Because of the state boundaries, to get that kind of, you know, yeah, we talk about the, I can't remember what we call it in New York now, the metro area, whatever it is, but that's more a rhetorical gesture than an actuality. And of course, you know, if you think about the environment, you think about watershed regions and so on, and anyway, there are different forms of governance that are slowly being put into place, but just on the anecdotal, personal level, I'm reminded of how funny I feel when I hear people say that they come from, let's say, Chicago, but in fact they live in a suburb of Chicago, and they fly into and out of O'Hare, which is not exactly, because airports are not inside cities anymore, and are in the hearts of cities, and they, you know, they might live this totally suburban life, but they, when they're asked where they come from, they say, I come from Chicago, or, you know, any of the other cities that are identified as the location of a regional airport, but in fact there's nothing city-like about these people's lives, habitat. So I'm not anxious about that, but it's just something to think about. Yes, please. I'm wearing my reading glasses, so I'm not calling on you by name. Yes, please.
I'm Dick Simpson, head of the political science department here. And I wish all of our students and faculty were hearing your talk, because I agree with many of the things you say about urban sociology that applies to a lot of the politics that's written about in various forms. And I guess one of the things picking up on Hunt's point is how about bringing politics back in? Most of the papers that have been delivered here had a political dimension. Jim's point about Native Americans, obviously, is a political problem. Your paper about immigrants in Berlin is a political problem. But some sociologists don't seem to really get to the issue of changing the policy or changing the power structure in a very explicit way. Political scientists know way too little about the actual society and the overall lives. It would seem one part that would be useful, if urban is Dennis, I'm not sure how to do my faculty here, I would tell you the number of people who teach urban politics is smaller than the number of people who teach urban sociology. So there might be a useful, in fact, I think there is. If you even go back to the old Chicago school, yes, all the sociologists were down one hall, but the political scientists who remade political science into what I call modern political science and did urban, all did studies in Chicago, and were profound studies in Chicago in political science. There was a fruitful interplay that wasn't always made explicit, but was very useful on both sides. And of course, here, Jane Addams would have criticized all of them as not paying very much attention to the work. But it was a fruitful connection.
Excellent point. Yeah. We sociologists often do write about everything, so we might as well write about politics too. Yeah, please.
I think I'm also more optimistic than you are, because your metric is looking internally within sociology, but I think another metric that you can use is to look externally at how much urban sociology has had influence outside of our
knowledge. That makes me even more anxious.
No, but I think that not only within sociology, but you know, the kind of ancillary field I'm in, social epidemiology, is completely and almost totally informed by urban sociology. And to the extent that we can draw those connections, and I think the stories that you're talking about are missing within public health. I think there's a lack of knowing kind of the ordinary processes through which people go and how that affects their health and their health behaviors, as we go from infectious disease to behavioral disease, which is kind of main drivers of health and healthcare in the United States. I think there's a real role for us outside of our immediate urban sociology that we've become so accepted in many ways that we've now started influencing other fields. And it's one of the few fields I know that is sociology where, if we're talking about urban problems, sociologists are expected to be at the table, not just economists or political scientists or doctors. I mean, we're expected to be there in many ways. So I think I'm more optimistic looking out at how urban sociology has been on other fields as well.
Okay, good. I'm glad to be proved wrong, to be anxious. You know, I think about various discussions that I'm in sometimes in New York City where I'm introduced as an urban sociologist, but everybody sees me as the socialist, because the sociologists are the socialists in terms of their opinions about policy changes. So I haven't felt terribly influential as an urban scholar, but maybe I should feel better about it. Harvey.
Well, the following often is actually less so of who's the other disciplines. Sort of two thoughts that may or may not be related. And one is geography. Mm-hmm. And you did make reference to geography, but then as you spun out your story, which I much appreciate, I'm wondering, how would you situate the difference between geography and sociology and urban sociology as you worked it through, putting as you do space and or place as a central? What is the difference? And the other, I'm wondering how you get to about what seems to me, and this is the way in which other disciplines speak for sociology in general and urban sociology in particular, it's the economist stupid. That ideas that we have had for generations, one economist says it, and then that becomes the public, that commands public and policy attention. And so, are we losing? Is that a win because those are our arguments, or is it that our loss because we have no consequence unless an economist says it?
Yeah, this question of multidisciplinarity and our relation to other disciplines is an important one. And again, I'm sorry, I didn't have time to address that either. I think most U.S. sociologists, you and me accepted, of course, don't feel close to geography. I'm just guessing this, but I would guess that most of the people in this room do not read geography. Might be good, might be bad, I don't know, might be neither. But I think that many or some U.S. urban sociologists are doing work that is very much at home in geography, at least in part of geography, part of the human, social, cultural geography world. And those geographers whom we're close to are close to us, so that there is a very fruitful exchange, correspondence, cooperation, mutual borrowing between some of us and some of them. But maybe there should be even more of an exchange between urban sociologists and geographers.
What I'm asking is, what's the difference at all? Should we abolish geography or abolish ourselves?
They're bigger than we are. I don't know. This is something that I suspect we're running out of time to discuss, but this is something that I've also thought about and something I think urbanists should discuss. It used to be in the 1980s that it was psychologists who had a dominant voice in public discourse. And nowadays it's economists, so we never get our licks in. Okay. Sorry.
You forgive the use of this metaphor, but I have to displace Sharon right now. You see? It's all over the place. But I think this... We have plenty of time to carry on the conversation. As usual, she is a wonderful provocateur. So, she raises important issues. And, we've got another few hours today. Maybe in the last session, some of these issues can be raised again. But thank you so much.